Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone out this morning. We have some visitors with us. Thank you for being here. You should know, as mentioned a couple times, our two normal evangelists are out today, so very unfortunate for all of us. But I'm in 1 Kings chapter 18. I would invite you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. Similar topic to what Mike mentioned, actually, in reflection of the Lord's Supper. In 1 Kings 18, this is one of my favorite Old Testament stories. And so the plan this morning is, let's read it. I think there's a lot of great applications that we can make for us today. So 1 Kings chapter 18, we're going to start a little bit abruptly. We're going to look in verse 17 with Elijah and King Ahab. 1 Kings 18, verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, O troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have in your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord, he is God, follow him, but if Baal, follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but the Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut into pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I'll prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call on the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And the people said, "It is well spoken." Verse 25, then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull, prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped around the altar they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. He repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. And Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with these stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench around the altar as great as would contain two seas of seed. And he put wood in order, cut the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill four jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you, O Lord, are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you are God, and that you have turned their hearts back." Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." And they seized him, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishron and slew them there. That's one of my favorite Old Testament stories. It really is. And so again, this morning, there it is in front of us. Let's talk about it. Let's make a few application points to it. So the thing is, story, what's the main characters, right? So if verse 1 is easy, it's Elijah. So what do we remember about Elijah? One, he was a prophet of God. He did many great things for God's people, many miracles. It's interesting, his name means "My God is the Lord," which is interesting. If you recall, how did Elijah die? Well, he's one of the few people in Scripture that didn't die, remember? So when it was his time to depart, a chariot of fire came down. He was taken up in a whirlwind. But remember, that's not the last time we see Elijah. So think back, New Testament, think forward. He, along with Moses, appeared at Jesus' transfiguration in Mark chapter 9. So to summarize, again, Elijah, great prophet of God, was a great instrument for God to his people. So number two here, we have Ahab. So King Ahab, he was king over Israel. We might remember he was an evil king. He worshipped his wife Jezebel's false gods, the Baals specifically. We read in Scripture that Ahab built a temple. He built many shrines to the Baals, or to the Baal, I should say, plural or singular, I guess. One interesting note, though, it's kind of sad and maybe even depressing. The names of King Ahab's kids all had names signifying praise to God, praise to Jehovah, praise to Yahweh, the Israelite God, which is so sad. So it appears, although he had some recognition possibly of who God is, the true God, he chose, though, to worship Baal. It was he, this is one of his worst deeds, who stood by idly while his wife ordered the execution of all of God's prophets at this particular time. 1 Kings 16, verse 30 defines his legacy. It says, Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So we have Elijah. We have Ahab. But if you recall, you can't mention Ahab without mentioning something about his wife Jezebel. So it appears she wasn't at Mount Carmel. So she wasn't here at this demonstration, but she does play a part in our story that we just read. Unlike her husband, she wasn't an Israelite. So she was from, I think it was Phoenicia, Phoenician princess. Ahab's father, Omri, arranged this marriage to strengthen ties between the two kingdoms. Again, she was a worshiper of the Canaanite gods, Baal and Asherah. You know, this woman, we can read about it, probably familiar, she almost single-handedly tried to wipe out the worship of Jehovah in the land of Israel. If you recall, remember, she was the one that orchestrated the death of Naboth so Ahab could take his vineyard from him. And again, the she wasn't at Mount Carmel, but these prophets of Baal and Asherah, these are her men. She organized them. She fed them. So her influence is definitely present in our story this morning. So let's get the setting, okay? So in verse 17, Ahab and Elijah meet, and Ahab says to Elijah, "Is it you, O troubler of Israel?" So what's he talking about? He's talking about Israel is in the midst of a drought. Ahab blames Elijah for this drought because Elijah prophesied that it was going to happen. So when they come together, that's why he says, "You're the trouble of Israel." He's talking about the drought specifically. But Elijah says, "I'm not the trouble of Israel. You're the troubler because you abandoned the commands of God and served the Baals." So instead of continuing to engage Ahab in this back and forth, if you will, Elijah, I would say, issues a challenge. Challenge, demonstration, showdown maybe is a good way to think about it. And he tells Ahab, "Hey, summon all of Israel to Mount Carmel. Hey, bring those prophets of Baal," right? The prophets of Baal, the prophets of Asherah, bring them there as well. In contrast, we probably should make note, these prophets, false prophets, they lived a life of ease, right? So we just mentioned they ate from the royal family. They were supported. They were cared for by the royal family. That's a big contrast to the prophets of God during this particular time, who many times had to hide in caves, we read about, for fear of being put to death. But regardless, King Ahab agrees, and everybody comes together. at Mount Carmel. And what does Elijah say? He says, it's time to make a decision. He says, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord's God, follow him. If it's Baal, follow him. He says, it's time to make a decision. The implication, I think, or there's a few implications to that, it would imply, I think, that sometimes the people serve God. Sometimes they serve Baal. Maybe sometimes they try to serve both God and Baal. Or maybe sometimes they didn't serve anybody because they didn't know who the true God actually is. And if they were attempting to serve both God and Baal, Elijah's going to help them understand, those are two mutually exclusive loyalties. You can't serve both. A decision has to be made on what you're going to do. And so, people of Israel, decide who you're going to serve. You can't have it both ways. What do the people say? Do they say, you're right, we're sorry, let's serve God? Let's say, sad words, the end of verse 21. But the people did not answer him a word. They didn't have anything to say. Elijah presents the case, he says his piece, tries to get them to see the error of their ways. Sad words, sad words. They didn't answer him a word. I think we could probably maybe relate to a certain degree. How do you think Elijah felt about that? How sad is that? You know, you could almost maybe think to yourself, or maybe hear him say humbly, okay, today I'm going to show you who the true God is, and specifically what he is capable of doing. Elijah then tells the people that he is alone against the prophets of Baal. He is the only one here to stand boldly, publicly, against the king and his wife's prophets. So that's the setting. Let's kind of get into the specifics of the demonstration now. So Elijah tells the people, hey, there's a way to test to see who the true God actually is. And so two bulls or oxen are going to be used as sacrifices. The prophets of Baal, hey, you're going to go first. You're going to prepare the bull, put on the altar, call upon the name of Baal. I'm going to do the same. I'm going to call upon the name of Jehovah, the Lord God. And the God who answers with fire, that is the true God. This is going to help in your decision process, right? I think that's the purpose of it, or one purpose of it, I should say. Notice at this point, the people have something to say. They didn't say anything before, but now they say, that's a good idea. Let's do that. That's well spoken. So apparently it seems maybe a little more bought in, maybe at this juncture. But something else we need to mention probably about the specifics here. So this is being held on Mount Carmel. Okay? So as we mentioned, Israel's in the midst of a drought. Okay? So roughly about 3.5 years. Would Mount Carmel be a good place for this type of demonstration? And if you think about it, it's probably the perfect place to have this type of demonstration. So remember, Mount Carmel, it's really kind of a range of mountains, the Mount Carmel Range. It's around the Mediterranean coast. It's high in elevation. It's super lush. It's kind of dense, if you will. Reason being, it would make it practically impossible to say, hey, Elijah, some spark from a rock lit yours on fire, right? Or some trickery was involved. If this would have been held maybe further south when it's hot and dry, maybe people could say, well, yeah, some other kind of reason you can explain away how fire lit an unlit altar. Mount Carmel here, the possibility of trickery or something like that, non-existent. Not going to happen, just due to the topography and whatnot. One other thing I think we need to think through around the specifics here, Baal. So Baal was the god of fertility, but he was also the god of weather. And so statues and depictions of Baal at this time often showed him holding two lightning bolts in his hand. So I think you have to ask the question, who theoretically had the advantage here? Baal is the god who controls the weather. He carries lightning bolts at his disposal. This challenge is being held on Mount Carmel, where the possibilities of random, you know, sparks of lighting an altar are non-existent. So who holds the advantage? Well, theoretically, Baal holds the advantage in this entire demonstration. It seems like Elijah has played into his hands. He's alone, and he's against the storm god himself. And so as we just read, the challenge now begins, though, which is interesting and encouraging. The prophets of Baal, they got their ox, cut it up, put it on the altar. We read that from morning to noon, they call out to Baal and say, "O Baal, answer us." And in verse 27, it says they leaped about the altar which they had made. Some versions, your version may say it's like a ceremonial dance, if you will, to try to, entice a response from Baal. Yet no one answered. So at noon, though, we read of, maybe to your point, maybe some of the humor located in scriptures to a certain degree. Elijah calls out, and he mocks the prophets of Baal. He says in verse 27, "Hey, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he's occupied, gone aside, on a journey. Maybe he's asleep, and you need to wake him up." Elijah taunts, pokes fun at the prophets of Baal. And some might ask, you know, well, okay, was that necessary? Think about it from the point of view of Elijah, through his eyes. Elijah knows who the true God is. He knows Baal's not a god. He knows these false prophets are to a false god, not real. He just listened to them yell and call on Baal from morning until noon. And when he doesn't answer, hey, you start dancing around. Let's hope to entice. You get my point, right? The sarcasm. This is somewhat ridiculous. How could Elijah sit there and not say anything about this spectacle that was going on? A god that would be distracted by the things Elijah made mention of would be no god at all. Such a god's a joke, not worthy of praise, adoration, worship, and all that. Yet, when we see, hey, it can't get any more ridiculous, what happens? It only spurred the prophets of Baal on even further. They start cutting themselves according to their customs until the blood rushed out. Here's the key verse, verse 29. When midday was past, they raved until the evening. I was reading from the ESV, the offering of the obligation. That's the evening sacrifice. But, quote, "There was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention." Okay. So, now it's time for Elijah, actually, more accurately, for the Lord to take center stage in this demonstration. By the specification of the challenge, the prophets of Baal, hey, you were given a fair chance. You can't say something was unequitable or not fair or anything like that. You had your chance. Now Elijah is going to show them who the real, true, living God actually is. And so he does a few things unique, right? So one, he gathers all the people together, and he gets 12 stones, and he rebuilds an altar to the Lord. He arranges the wood, the oxen. He does something different, though. He cuts a trench around the altar. We read that he soaks the altar multiple times with water, so much water that it fills the trench completely up. So again, kind of what's the point there? The point is he's making this thing seem as difficult as possible, for the Lord, taking it another step further. Again, can't claim you're being tricked here. Verses 36 and 37, we read, the humble prayer of a servant of God. In Elijah's prayer, he confirms to the people, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. The people just saw that Baal's not a god, but really, that's probably half the objective, right? The other half objective is, I'm going to show you who the true God is. It's not Baal, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, Israel, Jacob, that is your God. And so he calls upon the Lord, quote, "so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God." How long did they have to wait? Probably not very long. Probably not very long at all. They didn't have to wait for an answer. The prophets of Baal literally waited all day. No one answered. Elijah makes a simple prayer that probably wouldn't have taken much time. In verse 38, we see the Lord sent fire, consumed everything. The wood, the offering, the stones, the dust, the water, trench, the fire was complete. It was efficient. It was true. And it showed who the true Lord is. The Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Lord who delivered his people from Egypt, the Lord who gave them that land of Canaan, the Lord who cared for them, took care of them, he is the true and living God. Look at verse 39 we just read. The people, what'd they do? They didn't see the fire and say, I'm glad we settled that issue. I'm so glad. Yes, the Lord is God. It's evening time, you know, time for dinner and go home. And no. They acted in the appropriate, logical, rational way. They fell their faces to the ground and they worshiped God. They said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. They say it twice. They recognized the magnitude and the authority of who the true God was, is, and they acted accordingly. Last verse we read, the story doesn't end there necessarily. Elijah doesn't let these evil prophets off the hook, if you will. They were rounded up, taken down by the brook Kishon, and Elijah slew them there. Two things I want us to remember about this part of the story. One, this was a purging of evil. You know, these individuals, these prophets, false prophets, were partly responsible for turning the people's hearts away from God. Yes, I think we all understand, people decide not to follow God. But these prophets helped them do it. And then two, this is a powerful and strong reminder that there is no middle ground between God and Baal. These false prophets made the wrong decision, and they suffered the consequences as a result. So like I said at the beginning, this is one of my favorite stories. Given the context, the characters involved, the demonstration, more importantly, the outcome, how can you read it and not be encouraged about the great God? You know, Wednesday night in our Genesis class, I think Mike may have mentioned that, I don't recall. Someone made the comment that the God of the Old Testament, he's our God today. The God that was at Mount Carmel that consumed this altar, he is the exact same. People change. God doesn't change. And so there's a lot of encouragement I think we can derive from that. So I jotted down four application points. Four application points that let's briefly talk about and then we'll finish up. Number one is probably the easiest one, I think anyway. The people had to make a choice. Do we need to make a choice as well? Yes. So one, a choice has to be made. Elijah gathered the people together and again, he said, how long are you going to do this? How long are you going to hesitate between two opinions? If it's God, follow him. If it's not God, follow him. He told the people, they need to make a choice, and we need to make a choice as well. Is this the only time in the Old Testament where God's leaders encouraged the people, hey, you need to make a choice, you need to make a decision? Absolutely not. This is one small example. I think about Moses, in one of his farewell addresses in Deuteronomy chapter 30, he says, choose life. He presents to him, I've sent before you death and adversity or life and prosperity. Choose life that you might live. Think about Joshua chapter 24, right? Choose for yourselves today whom you're going to serve. Me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. The point is, making a choice is nothing new. Nothing new. It's something that constantly has to be done. And we have to do that as well. You know, sometimes we too, maybe like the people, we get caught up in our own bales, our own issues, and we start hesitating between two opinions, as Elijah said. Sometimes our faith starts to waver, and we get caught up in the things of the world. And what happens is our true allegiance to God, I mean, that's the thing that suffers. That's the thing that diminishes. That's the thing that gets smaller. Or, sadly, that's the thing that could disappear if we're not careful. We, too, must recognize, like the people needed to, obviously a choice has to be made. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 6? He says, no one can serve two masters. There is no middle ground here, people. No middle ground between loyalty to God and commitment to some other perceived rival, no matter what that is. We need to remember, you know, you and I, we're not born into being a Christian. We're not made in a certain sense into being a Christian. How do we become a Christian? We choose to be a Christian. It's an active choice and one that we need to remember to make. And may God help us to do that each and every day. Number two, sometimes we might have to stand alone. Elijah was the only person at Mount Carmel, at least publicly, boldly, proclaimed his allegiance to the Lord. He stood alone against these hundreds of false prophets. Sometimes, sadly, scary maybe, we might have to do that too. Chances are at some point in your life, if you haven't already, you may have to take a stand. Well, let me back up. You will have to take a stand, but you might be alone when you have to do it. That is tough. That is difficult stuff. Maybe at work, maybe at school, maybe not even a place you thought it would happen at, but there comes a time, typically, that a stand has to be made for what's right. And as we see from Elijah here in Mount Carmel, there comes a time when private faith must become public loyalty. Private faith must become public loyalty. And again, that's certainly hard to do. It's hard to confront others, make a stand when you're standing alone. No doubt it's hard for Elijah, I'm assuming. Here's the point, though. How was Elijah able to get through that? Hundreds of prophets. He alone, I alone, am left prophet of the Lord. How was he able to get through it? So the question is, was he alone? Absolutely not. Will we be alone in our time of making a stand, our time of commitment? Absolutely not. The Lord was with Elijah on Mount Carmel. The same God will be with us today as well. We can take strength, we can take comfort from that fact. New Testament's full of passages and examples and commands that we're not going to be alone. 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. God is faithful to his people. He will not abandon us in our time of need, just as he didn't abandon Elijah as well. Number three, we must completely destroy sin. Again, much has kind of been made through the centuries of Elijah killing the prophets of Baal. And you know, again, we must remember, one, Elijah's a prophet of God who acted on God's authority. But I think there is a lesson there for us. And it's that, as Elijah did, we must destroy sin completely and utterly from our lives as well. That's to be a follower of his, to be a Christian, that's what it's all about. This is what Paul talks about in the book of Ephesians, right? We're familiar with it. Paul says, hey, specifically, there are some things you need to put off. And then, and likewise, there's some things you need to put on to be the new self. Not the old self with its sin that's so entangled in it. Put on the new self, which is in the likeness of God. That we're to be imitators of God as his children. And the only way to be an imitator of God as his children is to remove, purge ourselves from the sin that we can obviously get wrapped up in. It takes work to destroy sin. But again, we can do it with God's help. Last one. The Lord is the true and living God. The whole reason this demonstration took place in the first place, in 1 Kings 18, is because the people had turned their back on God. They had turned their hearts away from God. And over time, it seems like they had, in essence, maybe forgotten, again, who God is, what he's done for them. So the implication is pretty simple. Are we ever in that situation? False prophets and these other people were telling God's people, the Baal, those are your gods. As Mike mentioned, there's several examples in the Old Testament saying, behold, this is your God. Do we ever get confused? Do we ever forget? Do we ever not recognize who the true God actually is? I would suggest to you guys, sadly today, as in those days, people forget. People today don't recognize who God is. Sometimes we put our things in other gods. We put our loyalties in, you know, wealth, position, power, jobs, family, hobbies. And we lose sight of the fact of what happened on Mount Carmel, of the true and living God manifested himself in such a way that there was no confusion at all. The Lord, the God of heaven and earth, sent fire, consumed the offering and the altar. Make no mistake about it, he is God, the true and living God. And like the people here, when you recognize authority, what do? You act accordingly. The people were confused. They didn't have much to say at the beginning. At the end, they had a lot to say. At the end, they said, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God, with their faces bowed down to the ground. They praised his name. And my friends, we must and should do the exact same thing. The God that showed himself again in his power on Mount Carmel, he's our God today. And he commands the same response of us that the people showed all those centuries ago, back in 1 Kings 18. So there you have it. Again, one of my favorite Old Testament stories. Again, the characters involved, the specifications, the fantastic outcome. Again, how can you read that and not be encouraged to serve the true and living God this morning? So thank you for your kind attention. We're going to sing a song of invitation. I hope you've been encouraged. And hopefully, you know, this week as we're going through it, think about, and again, it's kind of hard to do, right? On a mountain, thousands and thousands of miles from here, centuries ago, a very cool, wonderful, encouraging, perfect event took place that gave people confidence that no matter what their circumstances are, no matter what they've done in the past, they refocused, they rededicated, they recognized, they remembered, they learned who the true God is. And I think I'm planning on trying to take that with me this week as I go about my week, and I hope you will as well. And so the 4 points again to remember. One, a decision has to be made. Two, we might be standing alone, but we can take comfort in the fact that God will be with us. Three, we must completely, utterly purge sin from our lives. And that four, the God of 1 Kings chapter 18, he is the true and living God, and he'll be God today, tomorrow, until Jesus comes back. So if we can help you be right with this true and living God, in whatever way you may not be right with him this morning, let us know what we can do as we stand and sing to encourage each other.